Of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Innocence of Islam Controversy, the Lusala Monkey, Parking Richard III, and a second look at Fairgates. Let's begin episode 182.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your philosopher, political scientist. Ethan, I don't know if you've been following the news, but there's another bit of a kerfuffle in the Middle East. Have you heard anything about this?
There's a new kerfuffle.
Apparently, there's been a quote-unquote preview of a movie called Innocence of Muslims that was released on YouTube and has sparked your, I hate to say this, sort of classic rioting and violence in the Middle East, culminating, or at least the most worst part of it, is the murder of the U.S. ambassador to Libya, as well as three other of his sort of co-workers. There have been attacks on embassies and American properties in Egypt, Sudan, Yemen, and I'm sure a few others that I'm missing. Actually, even a number of European consulates and businesses have also been attacked, just assuming that they're part of the Western conspiracy against Islam. Now, if you've seen this sort of Innocence of Muslim, it is sort of a, how do we put this? It's pretty vile in many ways. I mean, it touches all the huge, you know, sort of thing. Muhammad was a pedophile. Muhammad was gay. Muhammad was just a real horrible person. And it doesn't do it in the same sort of way that perhaps we might do on the show to say, you know, here's something that we find inconsistent with the Islamic faith. The whole idea of calling this the innocence of Muslims is to sort of get Muslim people to come in and look at this and say, hey, they're on our side, and then really essentially just insult them as harsh and as hard as you can. Have you seen this video yet?
Well, actually, I haven't seen the video, but from what I have heard of it, you know, the description is fairly similar to what you've described, that it's not really what we consider any kind of either scholarly or even very serious investigation of Islam or Muhammad or really any of these matters. It's more of sort of a kind of designed to be incredibly insulting video. Of course, you know, the flip side to that is an insult proper provocation for murder and rioting? I would have to say no, but there is a certain element to this video that is meant to be simply provoking and antagonistic at the very least.
Exactly, and I think there are some, and I'm going to call them cultural differences, because I don't know if I feel quite as secure at blaming Islam in particular for this, because I think you get similar outbreaks of this kind of violence over other issues in places like Southern Africa, like the LGB rights and that sort of thing. So I think it has more to do with poverty and the government. But that being said, I discovered in some of my research that this is actually a renaming of the movie that was originally released in the United States. Actually, it really is a movie, apparently. But it was called The Innocence of Bin Laden. And it has it was released. It had on the promotion card a lot of Arabic on it saying, you know, listen, you've been subjugated for a long time. Find out who the real enemy is. You know, it's Bin Laden wasn't the bad guy. Really, he's just been a put-up person. And watch the show and you'll find out who the real Satan sort of is. And of course, like I say, then you go in and you see this. And it was originally, like I say, it's really directed at Muslims. One of the funny things, and I posted this link on our website, I believe, or sorry, our Facebook page. One of the things at the bottom of the poster that was advertising the innocence of bin Laden was a phone number. And this is hilarious. Chink Ugar of the Young Turks did a thing on this. And apparently his producer phoned the number. It was at the bottom of this poster. And it was one of those numbers that says, this is going to cost you $3.99 a minute. So they got, you know, one of those gift Visa cards, and they put it in. And then it says, we are now going to charge your Visa card $119. And, of course, it doesn't say for what. And then at the end of that, it says, okay, you can now leave any comments you want in any language. Thank you very much. Which just strikes me, on the one hand, like a big money scam. But then I thought about it again. If you're sitting there and you did this video, and it was really intended to annoy and upset sort of Western Muslims, because it was done in California, and you don't get the quite same hysteria as you get there. But you add on top of it the sort of money scam. I mean, it's really double rubbing it in. It really is going to make them really, really upset, perhaps with a hope that it'll spark them to violence, even in some place like California.
Well, yeah. I mean, if it is a monetary scam, that's not really surprising, actually, when you think about it. I mean, the types of material that's produced designed to provoke violent reaction usually doesn't have the best of intentions behind it.
No. And that goes back now to what Ethan had said that he's uncomfortable with. And I think in many ways, a lot of people have been kind of defending this on the idea that it's free speech. And I don't think it is. I think this is one of those areas where this sort of free speech is equivalent to someone going into the proverbial theater yelling fire. I mean, like I say, there doesn't really seem to be any merit to this other than to overtly incite violent activities. And you were right. You know, I don't think that any form of insult, be it religious or otherwise, should constitute an excuse for violence or murder. And that's where this also becomes quite interesting, because as more and more reports come in, it seems that this video was just a convenient opportunity for an actual sort of assassination attempt by people who were really annoyed at this particular government in Libya. Let us remember that sort of one of the fears originally about the supporting of the rebels in Libya was it was going to be taken over by sort of the Muslim Brotherhood or some other radical Islam group, and that never really happened. And there's reports beforehand that they were going to seek revenge on the Americans because they have to blame them for everything. So the rioting that occurred about this video was just a good opportunity for them to do a sort of more precision strike. But going to the other issue about, well, why do they always seem to burn effigies and they riot and they try and kill people in these countries? I got a really interesting insight into that when I was watching another news report. I think it was the CNN or CBC in Cairo when they were, you know, rioting about the video. And one guy he started sitting there and he was saying, you know, yes, the Americans are bad. And I know they've condemned it, but they should have done it earlier. And in the background, you know, the government forces were sort of pushing back and they were fighting back at the rioters. And the guy turned and he says, you see what the Americans are doing? This is all because of them. They're the ones who are supporting our government, which is oppressing us. And because of that, we don't like them. And there's a lot of conspiracy theory that goes on in the Middle East that blames any of the sort of local problems on America, the West. The recent election of the Muslim Brotherhood is actually a plot by Hillary Clinton to put in, you know, this sort of controlling factor over Egypt so it can remain a puppet of the United States. So if you factor that sort of things into it, I don't think it's quite fair to blame sort of just the religious movement of it. And Lord knows, pun intended, that I don't ever want to really defend that sort of religious sentiment. But if you look back at places like in Nigeria, where you get similar sort of actions, in Uganda, again, the people who are getting the worst of it seems to be the homosexuals. There is the witchcraft that we talked about in other episodes, which seem to be pointing at different subjects, but the underlying problem seems to be sort of the social inequality, political oppression that occurs in these countries. So, but maybe I'm off kilter here.
Well, you know, it isn't a universal violent reaction either. There were lots of reports and photographs from some of these areas where people were holding up signs saying, sorry to America for your dead and stuff like that. You know, it wasn't like every Muslim everywhere suddenly went crazy or something. There were lots of people there who were, I'm sure, just as horrified by the violence as anyone else were. And, you know, unfortunately, that story isn't really getting played up in the news.
No. And to move a little away from this, you may have also heard, Ethan, about in Pakistan, there is someone who supposedly, because there's some doubt about this, a girl, teenager perhaps, who suffered from Down syndrome and has been accused of blasphemy in Pakistan. And they're going to, you know, they're trying to get her arrested and all that. There's been a bit of a backlash going the other way, but it's there's been, again, another big kerfuffle about this. I was listening to another one of my documentaries, and they were talking about this, and a lot of the people who were politicians in Pakistan were sort of supporting the blasphemy law in general, but they were pointing out that really what's happened with these blasphemy laws is they're not so much about the blasphemy, but it has become a convenient tool to sort of knock down your opponents. So in particular, one of the interesting facts that I picked up about this particular girl in question is Christian. And you say, well, okay, but why was she Christian? Well, she was also a garbage collector or part of the caste system that were the untouchables. When Islam first came to India, that was Hindu country, and they had the caste system, so you had your different levels. When Islam came, they by and large kept the caste system intact and didn't really change it. But when the British came in, the British said, hey, we don't like this, this is horrible. And they pushed to get rid of it. So these people who were in like the untouchable class, they were in the lower class, said, oh, great, we're going to be like the British, so we're going to convert to Christianity, and that will save us from this fate. And oddly enough, of course, it didn't, because they didn't have anything to do with it. They were just considered to be second-class citizens, and irrespective of what tag. In fact, from what I understand, and again, this is my limited knowledge on the subject, if you say you're a Christian in some parts of these, that's really sort of code word for saying you're an untouchable. So what made this interesting is that this girl was a Christian and someone wanted to get rid of the Christians from this neighborhood. They wanted to put up a mosque and they wanted to use their land. So it was convenient to sort of frame, and that's where the story gets interesting. She turns out that apparently she might have been completely framed. She was framed and used this blasphemy law just to get rid of the Christians because they've been trying to drive them out. Now, this is where it takes another weird twist, is that apparently an imam desecrated essentially a Quran and planted these desecrated verses into this girl's booklet to sort of amplify the horror of it. Because apparently the original book she apparently had, which she picked up because she was a garbage collector, was a book of verse, but not actually part of the Quran, part of the sort of secondary text of the faith. And he wanted to make sure the blasphemy stuck, so he planted this extra bit of evidence in there, which just struck me as so ironic that you know, if this was truly a religious horror, why would you do this? Have you heard any of this, Ethan?
Well, not really, actually. I mean, I've heard some of the story of the blasphemy case, which I think is really one of the reasons why blasphemy laws need to be taken out, is because they're used as convenient workarounds for, you know, subjecting human beings and trampling human rights.
No, I agree. And during the course of this particular segment I was listening to, which again was on the CBC, which is more neutral than most of the things that I tend to listen to, we're talking, you know, like one woman who was convicted of blasphemy. It originally originated in a dispute over wages for farm labor, and again had nothing to do with the thing itself. But one of the sad points, and I think this is where you're hinting at, Ethan, that it needs to be really looked at as a negative in the society, is originally there were a number of politicians and people who said, we need to get rid of these blasphemy laws, they're wrong. Those people have been, well, there's been one or two politicians who've been killed, a number of other people have had to leave the country. So now to say you're against these laws is in itself almost seen as a form of blasphemy, and you can be killed for it. And I think that was the thing that was really disturbing with this interview, was everyone was saying, yes, the system is broken. It really doesn't work. It really doesn't serve any sort of effective purpose, but we got to keep it because. And you could just sort of feel in the background that if they had said, we need to get rid of it because, you know, blasphemy really is sort of a silly thing in itself, or you shouldn't run a country based on blasphemy laws, they really feared for their life. So, you know, okay, so I've talked enough about, you know, Muslims, Islam, the badness and all that. Maybe this is a great chance just to sort of take a deep breath, a little pause, cup of tea, and we'll come back after this break. Standing on a planet, really I'm
just a speck, compared with a star. Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, we know that science discovers new animals all the time. Now, usually they're insects or fish or something small. But sometimes they find a big-ass monkey, and that's what's happened this time. Now, it's unusual for new mammals to be found, and not to mention monkeys in particular, but that's what we have here. In the Lomani Forest, a large lowland rainforest in the center of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, scientists have found the Leslula monkey. John and Teresa Hart, a conservation biologist based in the DRC, with the Luruku Wildlife Research Project, first came into contact with these primates back in 2007 when they saw a caged female in the home of a primary school teacher. The animal, the monkey in question, very interesting looking, has a mane of long grizzled blonde hairs framing a protruding pale naked face with a muzzle and a distinct cream-colored vertical nose stripe. It has human-looking eyes and a large blue bottom, as well as long black arms and legs.
Are you sure this isn't perhaps some movie star who wandered away?
Pretty sure. I think they wouldn't be in a cage in a schoolteacher's house. Researchers, through observation and genetic tests, have concluded that this wasn't some kind of hybrid or exotic accident or escaped movie star. Rather, this is a distinct species of primate and has never before been seen by science. Now, genetic analysis identified the species as a member of the Guenon group, meaning they live in sub-Saharan Africa. They are also old world monkeys, and scientists have named it the Ceropithecus lomanius, after the nearby Lomani River. And the researchers estimate that the range of this particular monkey is about 3,500 square miles in the central DR Congo. But unfortunately, these monkeys are most likely endangered as well. Now, scientists have already voiced concern that this relatively small distribution could make the animals vulnerable to human pressures, particularly bushmeat hunting and habitat loss. And it would, of course, be rather a shame to discover a new species and then have it go extinct shortly after.
Now, Ethan, I realize that you are not a biologist, but if this is a newly discovered species, how do they know that its range is so large?
Well, they've observed the area. I mean, they haven't just found it like yesterday. They've been searching for this since basically 2007. And basically what they've done is the particular area that they inhabit is bordered by a couple of rivers. And they haven't been able to detect the monkey beyond those rivers. So they assume that its range is relatively centralized in this particular area, which in some ways it actually means it would be harder for them to find this monkey because it's so localized. They're not going to find it through, you know, broad exploration of the DR Congo. But actually, they'd only really find it if they were looking in a very specific area. And that's also why it's so endangered, is because habitat loss or overhunting could really wipe this thing out relatively quickly.
So we spend so much time, you know, worrying about the small things. You know, are the stock prices going up? Am I going to have enough money for the new iPad? I mean, what about all this talk about the new iPhone 5 coming up, which, mom, dad, I'd like one, please? No. But here we have, you know, I mean, here's a species we've just discovered, part of the great tapestry of life. And it's going to disappear almost as soon as we've discovered it, because we don't seem to have the same value on life, on animals, on habitat that we tend to have on things. I mean, it just seems such a sad shame.
And it's actually a really amazing looking animal. You should look up the pictures of these things. Very striking and beautiful animal. I mean, it's just so unfortunate.
have different routes, rates, all that kind of stuff as well. So Vancouver's a bit unique in that respect.
Well, but unique in the world, but not unique in Canada. I think almost every mass transit system in Canada is actually publicly owned, with some exceptions where you got this sort of private public partnership. Mm-hmm. And to add to your explanation for those people who are not in the GVRD, which is the sort of lower mainland of Vancouver, Greater Vancouver Regional District.
Sure.
And the idea of SkyTrain, for those who don't know, it's essentially our subway. Some of the subways are above ground, some are the below ground. Because they're above ground, we called them the SkyTrain. It was a big expo thing back when you guys had expo. I wasn't in Vancouver at that time. But like I say, what I'm going to sort of deal around here is the whole idea of fare theft. And yes, there's a double meaning in that one as well. There's been a lot of changes to our regional mass transit system, due, of course, to some criminal instances on SkyTrain. There was the introduction of the transit police, complete with handguns. And this was done, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago. I think 2005 or thereabouts is when it came in.
Yep.
This was ostensibly to make the transit system safer for passengers, because there would be a dedicated security force to protect the ridership. Now, it is true there have been some horrific crimes in the past, but in 2009, they responded to about 28,000 incidences, which is, quite a lot. However, if you factor in that 25,000 of those 28 instances are crimes, were actually fare evasion, it seems, really? They spend most of their time checking tickets. Of all the other other crimes, less than half of them, granted a noteworthy number of them, were for violent crimes, although most of these were theft. The transit police came under fire this year after it was revealed that they were expected to issue at least 8 violation tickets per shift as part of their reasonable performance measure. Now, of course, the transit system itself accounts for anywhere from about 20 to 40 million, depending on the accountant that you use. So let's assume the lower number of about 21 million, which is the most consistent I found. And let's assume each one of them catches their quota of 8, and that in turn discourages, let's say, 10 times that number, just to do a fudge factor there. So there are 161 officers. So you do the math, carry the one, yada, yada. So they recoup, or save, depending on how you have this, for TransLink, less than about $50,000 a month, plus or minus a bit, depending on how their shifts work out. So let's take the shifts into account. So let's add another fudge factor of an incomplete order of magnitude, right? So let's say they actually managed to recoup $5 million in a year. So now that works out to be a net loss of $15 million a year for these particular officers. In a year where the TransLink itself says it has a $45 million shortfall on the horizon. Does that make any sense to you, Ethan?
Well, it doesn't make sense in the terms of stopping fare evasion, but how do you put a price on preventing someone from getting, pushed down a flight of stairs or pushed in front of the SkyTrain or, robbed or raped or something like that? When it's dark out and they're using the SkyTrain.
That is an excellent and very valid point. And I don't think I would have any huge issue with the whole transit cops in themselves if that's what they were doing. If they were patrolling to stop real crimes, then I'd say great. Because, I'm not saying there's no need for any kind of security on the mass transit system. I think there's a case to be made about what degree you have on it. But yes, there are crimes done. But how are they stopping someone being pushed down a flight of stairs when they're being distracted by checking to see whether you have an up-to-date fare pass or not? Mm-hmm. So again, I agree with you at one point, but I think you actually reinforce the point that I'm making, that it seems to be a bit of a misdirection of their efforts. Now, of course, we all noticed that in the lead-up to the Olympic Games, we had the green shirts, as I like to call them, appear at the SkyTrain stations, which were, of course, intended to help tourists navigate the system. We also noticed that with the assistance of transit cops, it seemed like actually their primary duty was to ensure that no one committed the immortal sin of hitching a free ride. In the infinite wisdom of our rulers, they've decided to add turnstiles or fare gates to all SkyTrain stations. The project, which is currently underway, will cost the fare payers and the taxpayers, because most of the money is actually coming from the provincial and federal governments, it will cost us about $171 million, not including upkeep. The gates are intended to be up and running about next year sometime, and are estimated to save / recoup TransLink about $7 million in, quote, lost fares. So let's just pause for an effect there. Maybe you missed that. So they're spending $171 million to save $7 million. Now, I'm not great at math, but that doesn't seem to be an effective use of money. So let's assume they get the return they're expected. But, I mean, this is quite unlikely. There have been turnstiles in other countries like London and other cities, and usually the amount they expect to reduce in truancy ridership is actually about half of what they're actually expecting to get here. So you'd actually expect about 3.5. But let's be optimistic, and let's use $171 million cost and $7 million in reduced truancy. We can expect the system to pay for itself in 25 years. And that's assuming the system will not need to be replaced due to, you know, age before that date. This strikes me as a bit of a classic case of being penny wise but pound foolish. TransLink also claims it will make the station safer because, as we know, criminals are allergic to turnstiles. Okay, it may keep out some vagrants out of the stations. It's never quite been a problem when I ride, and I ride quite often, and I pay all the time. And perhaps it will prove to be impossible for the very drunk to actually navigate through a turnstile. I mean, you have seen on occasion the really drunk person on a bus or on a SkyTrain who, frankly, is annoying and glad if they couldn't quite make it on there, although having them walk the streets may not be the safest thing in the world, but that's a whole other issue. But for the other kind of criminals that we're talking about here, so like, you know, the drug dealers, which are a large presence in our city, or the petty criminals, you know, the thieves and all that, $250 for a fare is just a minor cost of doing business. Of course, the big foolish assumption is that the people who don't pay can pay but choose not to. And it seems like our rulers totally assume that the people out there are morally evil, that they are just out to rip off the system, and they're doing it almost out of malicious intent. Well, the truth is, a notable number of the fare cheats are the homeless and the working poor, who literally cannot pay the fare, but often still need to use the transit system to get around. I mean, am I wrong?
Well, I would hazard a guess that's true. Has there been any studies or documentation to show that the majority of fare evaders are people who are lower income people who can't afford fare?
Yes.
Yes, good.
Anecdotal evidence.
Oh.
Well, actually, no. So I'm gonna actually flip that around. And because I will agree that from the evidence I've seen, and I've seen some people who've slipped on without, right? And almost all of them appear to be at least homeless. Now, of course, you can't tell of the more affluent whether they have slipped on or not for SkyTrain. But the TransLink itself just refers to them as fare evaders. And they don't actually say, well, hey, this person, you know, could have afforded to but didn't. Because they don't, I mean, when they grab you to say, hey, you don't have a ticket, they don't sit there and ask for your social economic standpoint. And actually, again, anecdotal, so we have to bear this with an extreme grain of salt. The ones that seem to be pegged out the most are youth, students who don't look like they have, that look radical, you know, the ones with the weird hairdos or the skateboards. A lot of sort of like Chinese student types I've seen pulled over. Rarely do people like me seem to get pulled aside, right? They sort of kind of give me a bit of a pass and woohoo, great to be white in our society. Mm-hmm. But it appears that the people who are availing themselves to this free service are those who literally just can't afford it. I mean, most people, and this is one of those arguments where they have the tragedy of the commons, there is a lot of people who believe that people will always try and rip off the system if they can get away with it. But science, study after study shows that people have a strong sense of social responsibility. I mean, I know I do, that if I have the opportunity and I can afford to pay my social things, I will do it. Because I know in the end, it benefits me, and it's the right thing to do. And most people do believe in doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, along the lines of sort of the, you know, anecdotal experiences, there's been a couple times when I've been, you know, taking the bus somewhere, and I'll notice someone who visibly looks poor. They have the obvious cues up. And they'll get on the bus, and the bus driver will say, oh, hey, Frank, because, you know, they see these guys, and they say, oh, you know, come on, Frank, just get on the bus. Just sit down, it's okay. You can't do that on the SkyTrain, though. There's no driver to have a relationship with. So I wonder if there is a certain percentage. I mean, I assume the Translink knows that happens. Like, they must know that that happens a fair bit. But, you know, they can't, when they have turnstiles on and you know, the enforcement on the SkyTrain, it seems to me that the SkyTrain is not seen as the same kind of community service as the bus system is seen by. Like, I see the SkyTrain more as sort of like, it's like the first class of transit almost. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, see, that's one of the funny things. I almost see it in a reverse. Not so much that I don't think the SkyTrain seems classier than a bus, because it does in many ways, right? But one of the things I love about this city and moving to this city that just was the idea that I can go from one city to another on a mass transit rapidly and quickly. I mean, where I come from in Brandon, right? You can go from Brandon to roughly Winnipeg, but you got to have a car or a truck or you got to catch great. And it's a huge ordeal. But I can go from West Vancouver to Langley, all in public transit, relatively fast for things. And it somehow makes this large, sprawling mass accessible to someone like me who doesn't want a car and probably could afford one even if he did have one. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I find that mass transit, especially SkyTrain, because it is so quick, it does join up so many things so much more efficiently, is actually of more use to the less affluent because it allows them to so much more increase their radius. So if you're looking for a job, for example, and you're the working poor, you're not limited to just lower Vancouver or to Burnaby. You can literally get a job in Richmond, and it's a bit of a pain, but it expands your horizons to such a large degree. Now, of course, that being said, there is an issue that needs to be dealt with, but I don't think that this sort of fare grabbing is the most effective way to do it. As I had mentioned earlier, TransLink is expected to have a budget shortfall of about $45 million in 2013. A significant amount of that is to pay for increased services, notably a rapid bus service for Surrey, Langley, and Cloverdale, a bus along the Portman Bridge, which was just recently upgraded, I believe. And there was supposed to be an additional 600,000 hours of transit service across the Lower Mainland. And trust me, for someone like me, this increased service can sometimes mean the difference between getting to a job on time or being late. And if you're late too many times, you get fired. The number 10 bus, it is so horrific as far as the number of times it seems to be late. And then you get these sort of three buses in a row syndrome.
Vancouver's a growing city, and our transit needs are constantly expanding. I mean, there's been discussion for the past, like, 5 years about putting in another SkyTrain or a rapid rail line going from, like, UBC out to Burnaby. So, I mean, there's lots of projects that are on the table, right?
Well, and let's not forget the Evergreen Line, which is supposed to hook up Coquitlam, which we don't think about. I mean, I think UBC has it just for the mass number of people, but UBC is well connected to the transit system. But as I say, this idea of shrinking the GVRD so that it's accessible to everyone, a line to Coquitlam adds the whole north eastern part of the Lower Mainland open to people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that brings us, you know, to say, well, let's remember why we have mass transit in the first place. The original idea, of course, is that a significant number of people, as I mentioned, can't afford to get around the city any other way. I mean, they can't afford a car. I mean, not only is it expensive to buy a car, but you have to license it, insure it, maintain it, not to mention the cost of gas. Mass transit provides a cost-effective way for the middle class and the working poor to have mobility and to get to their job. Of course, another reason that mass transit exists is its efficiency, which can be measured in at least three ways that I can think of. First, there are fewer cars on the road, meaning less traffic. For those who think traffic is bad now, imagine an additional 100 to 200,000 more people on the road in their own cars. And from the stats I read, SkyTrain alone has about 100 to 200,000, depending on, again, when the study was done, ridership every year. And that's not including the buses. Imagine if all those people had taken to the road. You think congestion is bad now. It's efficient also environmentally because, I mean, we have a hybrid system right now. Some of them are electric. Some of them are fossil-fueled buses. But even if they were all diesel-fueled, this it produces a lot less pollutants. I mean, including things like CO2 and all that, which are emitted. There are a few particles released in the air, which are, you know, irritants to people who have allergy or asthma. There's less smog, and it's just easier to breathe with less cars on the road producing less pollution. It's also efficient for when we do sort of wise up as a civilization and go completely carbon free, because it's going to be a lot easier to replace 1,000 buses than it's going to be to replace 1 million cars. Now, TransLink does need funding. We could jail people attempting to sneak in a ride, but ultimately, as we've already discussed, that costs more than it seems to gain. We could raise fares. However, that would only sort of serve to lower the ridership, thus lowering the revenues, and you start this sort of downward spiral that eventually allow the system to sort of wither away. Now, there have been some wise suggestions, though. There could be a relatively small levy applied to every vehicle sold in GVRD. This alone could raise upward of $30 million a year. A minor increase in property taxes, about 1% to 3%, would be enough to fund the system. For a property, just to give you an example how much that would cost you, for a property worth about $80,000, that would be only about $50 a year. And if your house is worth half that, $25 a year. There could also be a small surcharge on gasoline, which would not only help TransLink budget, but also encourage more ridership and also reduce our CO2 footprint. As little as a 2% increase on the gas taxes would only cost people about $2 a tax, $2 to a tank fill, but would cover, like I say, the increase that they need to improve the service. I guess ultimately my point is it's a little petty, I admit, but I hate feeling like a potential criminal every time I take SkyTrain. Of all the great injustices that occur in our great city, fare jumpers do not seem to warrant a dedicated security force. It does not warrant implementing a police state. What it does is sort of distract us from what I think is a real issue regarding public transit, that it needs to be expanded, access needs to be increased, and it needs to have adequate and reliable funding provided by society. Vilifying the ridership over pennies missed that will not garner the real money needed by the system to keep it going, the money it deserves.
Well, you know, Don, if you're tired of feeling like a criminal every time you take the SkyTrain, then you just have to back Sam Harris about racial profiling, and then you can fly everywhere.
Well, as I say, I sometimes think I get a free ride, no pun intended, or maybe I guess I did mean that.
Well, depends on if you are getting a free ride or not.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like the sort of presumption of guilt we have, right? I mean, you know, we become so much more of a security nation, so much more let's assume people are guilty, like Sam Harris, beforehand, mm-hmm. and that will somehow save society, even though when almost every empirical evidence sort of shows the reverse of that. And it makes life in the city, I mean, it's one of the great distractors. I don't like taking SkyTrain now whenever I see the cops up there. I should not be afraid of the cops. They are there to make life safer for all of us. But by having them do this extra role of being sort of instant judge and jury enforcer of petty little things, they can't really do their duty. I mean, how eager am I going to be to run to a cop saying, hey, I think that person over there looks suspicious, when the first thought in my mind is going to be, oh, I better check his fare ticket and that's okay, as opposed to, well, maybe this person really is dangerous and I should be looking after him. It puts them in the wrong moral space for them to really effectively do their job.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it also is a good lesson on how these conversations happen in the public sphere. I mean, the discussion over having like a property tax levy to pay for transit expansion. And the conversation typically goes, well, why should I pay for the transit expansion? It's like, okay, do you want to pay for $171 million of turnstiles put into transit? Well, no. Well, then take the levy, you dummy. I mean, like, there's really very little skeptical scrutiny or critical inquiry into any of these questions that happens in any kind of public dialogue about this. And it's a real shame because, you know, investing in transportation, it's always a good investment.
And there have been actually quite a number of studies have bared that out, that the greater the infrastructure is for public transit, the more affordable and accessible it is to people, the better it is for the city, not only in quality of life, but also in economic returns. Because again, let's talk about that property owner. I mean, how much is your value of your property going to be when your street next to you gets widened to three lanes to accommodate traffic that's going to include gas guzzling, belching sort of cars? How much more is your property value going to increase when you have a form of rapid transit nearby that makes your property accessible to the entire Lower Mainland? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there are so many more benefits to this than there are detriments.
Well, and also just pure bragging rights. I mean, Vancouverites love to brag about our city. And having a fast, reliable transit system is one of the best things to brag about. I mean, I was in London a couple of years ago, and people complained about the tube system. But honestly, it is a fast, efficient transit system. You know, the way that it's built serves that metropolis so well. And I've often thought that, you know, Vancouver's transit lines are very strangely laid out, whereas London has these, like, circles going outwards. And it's just fantastic. So, I mean, having a really good transit system that we invest our time and energy into, I mean, it is worth the cost because we get to say, ha-ha, our city is so much better than yours. And you know, so much fun.
Well, no, and it also goes to the thing, too, that because we have it, people tend to not think of it as a good thing. It's like, well, it's sure, I have SkyTrain, but I mean, it could be better. It does, you know, there is this stinky guy on the SkyTrain. Boy, it would be better if they didn't. You don't appreciate what it would be like if it wasn't there at all. And that, I think, is missed. It's kind of like people who sit there and they live at home and they say, oh, it's so horrible here. And then they move out and realize all the stuff that mom used to do for you. By the way, belated Happy Mother's Day. That mom used to do for you, or your parents used to, you know, you had free cable. Well, you move out. Suddenly you got to pay for the cable and you realize, shit, this costs money.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so many times we don't appreciate what we have and we just tend to criticize it. And that's never a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, which is a lesson to appreciate us while we're on the air.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. So I hope you were as angry as I was at that segment about the money that we're wasting on fare gates. But I've got some new information because it seems like if you take a look around, the battle to stop the fare gates has been essentially lost. They are now up at most of the SkyTrain stations, at least the ones that I've been. So they're here. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about, just so that there's some education, about the new Compass cards, which is going to be the way that these fare gates start operating. Apparently, these are going to be sort of RFID-based technology. You know, you sort of swipe the card as you walk by, and it takes the money off your cards. Now, one of the things I kind of found a bit disturbing is apparently the way these are going to work is that when you swipe the card, it charges you for three zones. Then when you go to the end of the bus, you get off the bus, you swipe it again, and it essentially gives you a refund on the unused zones that you didn't use. Now, this strikes me, there's just like a lot of problems with this. I mean, one, what if the technology doesn't go right and it charges you for three zones all the time? Apparently, there are a number of people that one bus driver I was talking to had said, well, people are just going to kind of go in the back, swipe it in one zone and then put it into like a lead shielded thing and then walk out the bus and only pay for one zone, even they got three zones. This doesn't seem to be a great idea in itself. That also said, it's based on RFID technology. Now, this is not, you know, I'm not going to get scary. It's going to cause you cancer or anything. But we had talked about in a previous show about the chips in your Visa cards and your bank cards and how it's possible for people to read these remotely. And again, remotely, we're talking 6 feet, maybe 6 feet, maybe less than that, 3 feet, So it's possible, and this has happened with other cards that use the same technology. Most notably, London has the Oyster card system, which is essentially based on the same technology. It's the same company that does it, where people have been able to hack into your cards. They've been able to take your money. They've been able to do all sorts of things. So again, a bit of an issue there. Another issue, of course, and I don't think this is a huge one, but one worth pointing out because everyone worries about this. Every card, of course, has a unique ID, and it is conceivable that they'll be able to track everywhere you go all the time. It's ominous, but not in a necessarily bad way, that the company that came up with this is actually a military defense contractor who does this sort of on the side. It's funny how life's little connections go. Now, the biggest thing that kind of makes me worry, and everyone should be really braced for, is a little thing called time. I was talking to one of the bus drivers on the system who apparently has been doing some experiments with this. He's a test drive or something. But everyone has to sort of swipe their card. And he says it takes about three or four seconds for people to do that before they can get on the bus. Whereas now, because you kind of show, it takes about 1 second. This apparently is going to slow down the system quite a bit. I mean, if you think about it, if everyone has to swipe this, you're going to get much longer delays at particular stations. And if you've noticed, too, in the SkyTrain stations, I mean, you've got the little stalls. Everyone's going to have to go through one at a time, open, close, and I could see horrendous lines starting to develop in this. I don't know if it was a big issue when the London one started up. I tried to do some research into this, but to be fair, London SkyTrains were quite overcrowded to begin with, so the added lineup you might have got from the fare system may not have been noticed because there was lineups already. Again, from what it looks like, is like everyone brace yourself. When these do get instigated, add an extra 10 or 20 minutes to get on and off the bus because it looks like that's going to be kind of an issue. Now, I am just kind of bitching. And to be fair, TransLink has last couple of days has just made my life heck for delays and missed buses. But Ethan, did any of these things resonate with you at all, or am I just, again, bitching?
Well, I mean, there are certain issues that I think definitely come up with this. Well, I mean, the three zone system, I think, works fine for the current system that we have, where you either get like a bus pass or you just pay at the bus or at the SkyTrain station and you can get a transfer. I think under those circumstances, the three zones work. But when you have basically a smart ticket, which is what this sort of is, and you preload it with money, and then you go around to different buses, SkyTrains, or C buses, or whatever you're using it for. And if you have to swipe it twice, well, that just seems silly. I mean, what happens if you get on a SkyTrain station, you ride your SkyTrain, say, into Vancouver, get off, get on a bus, and then take a bus to a different area? I mean, do you have to swipe your card on the bus twice to sort of turn off your smart ticket? Like, is that what they're suggesting here?
Well, again, these are all things to be worked out. But you're right. As far as transfers goes, you know, how is that going to work? These are things that I think are going to be huge technical difficulties when it originally comes out.
Why would you even need a transfer, though? Like, that's the whole point, right? Like, if this is a universal smart ticket, why would you need transfers or zones in the first place?
Because every time you swipe it, they take the money off the card.
Yeah, but why not just remove the whole middle operation and just take money off the card?
Well, so again, I think where we're getting to, and this is something we're going to have to learn about as it comes out, when you go on to one bus, you swipe on and you swipe off, and then you do the transfer and you swipe on and swipe off. Is it smart enough to know that the period of time between the first swipe off and the second swipe on is within a transfer period or not? Because if they don't have that, that means, you know, there will be no such thing as a transfer at all. So when you pay, every time you get on the bus, even if you're just going from one bus to another right away, you may be paying twice as opposed to, like you say, like the transfer like you're thinking of. But right. If they are smart, and we hope they are smart, then yeah, it will eliminate the transfer system. That could be a good thing.
Well, I mean, the whole point of the transfer system, though, is basically to navigate the zones. I don't really quite see why you need zones if you don't have transfers.
Right, because it's the distance you are traveling on the bus. So essentially, and again, this may be a foreshadowing of how they're going to change the whole system overall. But if you go on a Vancouver bus, then they're assuming you're going 50 blocks. If you go on a Vancouver bus and you go into Richmond, well, now you're going 100 blocks and they want to charge you double because you're going twice the average distance. And that, I think, is sort of where the zones come in. So in the zone, it's not going to be any different. But going from one to two zones, they say, oh, well, you're traveling twice as far, you're using up twice the gas, so we want to charge you more money. That's sort of why the zones exist, because they're charging you based on a very crude distance traveled, although sometimes it's farcical, because I can get on the bus in right by Marple here, go no more than three blocks, and I'm now in Richmond, and technically I've gone for two zones, and I pay the extra fare.
Yeah. It sounds like this whole new system is a really, really expensive way to solve a really minor problem.
Almost a non-existent problem. And actually, one of the big things that had happened in England, now that I remember, was they had some software glitches where people were being charged full fare all the time because it wasn't registering that you weren't working. I'm not looking forward to this at all. But what are we going to do? Does Vancouver have any embassies that we could burn?
The Translink embassy?
I guess not.
Probably not.
So, skeptical highlights. I have a couple. I have one. It's the Philosopher's Jam at Langara College, where I used to go. Transhumanism, enhanced human or diminished humanity. It's happening this Thursday, September 20th at 7 p.m. at the faculty and staff dining lounge at Langara itself. Cost is free. It's Peter McKnight, who is a columnist for Vancouver Sun. I looked at some of his articles. He doesn't strike me as a crazy. The talk is going to be about transhumanism dreams of using technology to deal with human limits. This includes the drive to defeat death and destroy disabilities and disorder through decoding DNA. Doubters declare these dangerous, dehumanizing, and even demonic endeavors. Is it our destiny or just some dandy fancy? Disturbing or good? So it looks interesting. It sounds kind of interesting. I suspect it's going to go into sort of the zeitgeist sort of movement. You know, the technology will cure everything. You know, in 50 years, they'll have a cure for cancer and that sort of thing. But they're always nice to see that some people put their faith in science, even if it's a bit fancy, over-the-top sort of faith. I have a second one, I believe. Fair Vote Canada. It's a dinner and chat that explores the ideas that bad government policy can only be addressed through a real consensus democracy. Again, this is one of your, you know, sort of leftist sort of events. It's being held at the Surrey Public Library at Surrey Centre. It's free. It's happening Friday, the 21st, at 5:30 to 7:30. So drop by if you're interested to find out what's going on about fair votes in Canada. Ethan, do you have any highlights?
I do. My highlight to this week is Cafe Inquiry Banned Books. This is happening Sunday, September 23rd at 11 a.m. at room 2270 of SFU Harbor Center. Cafe Inquiry is a monthly discussion group run by CFI Vancouver, and this cafe will focus on banned books, and it's presented by me. I will discuss some of the famous books that have been banned over the years. We will discuss some of the authority figures who have banned them. Why were they banned? And did banning books actually accomplish anything? So check that out. Like I said, September 23rd, Sunday, 11 a.m., SFU Harbor Center.
So Ethan, can you give us a little tidbit, a little taste? Tell us one banned book, just one that really should have been banned.
Well, I'm a big fan of Catcher in the Rye, and I think that we'll probably discuss a little bit about Catcher in the Rye. And we may touch on some of the strange conspiracy theories that surround Catcher in the Rye, like, does the book turn you into a terrorist?
I thought it turned you into a farmer.
Well, it very well could.
Well, I guess this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan saying, thanks for listening.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not at sunrise, but at galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truth.